The talk is now organized in this way. First, I'll give a short introduction to electrical impedance tomography and its main features as a medical imaging method. Then let's see the classical application of EIT imaging heart and lungs. Then I'd like to explain Dave's team's new spectacular findings in the field of detecting breast cancer at its early stage by combining mammography and EIT. Then I'll describe some very new results, still unpublished, from a project we have going on in Finland related to larynx and vocal fold imaging. And in the end, I'll discuss regularization issues for the ill-posed problem of EIT. Okay, so let's start with Dave's classical transparency. We would like to use electricity to both diagnose and treat disease. How can we do that? Well, we heard already about one of such applications in Yoram Rudi's talk. This is ECG, where the heart is studied by measuring voltages at the surface of the body. As we saw, one can deduce quite a lot about the condition of the heart by using such measurements. About treatment, everyone who has watched, for example, the TV program House knows that sometimes people's hearts stop. And what you do then, now I'm trying to mimic Dave. Dave says, if your TV set doesn't work, what do? You whack it, and probably it will resume normal operation. So this is the same case with the heart. You give it 3,000 volts, 20 amperes for 5 milliseconds. Every muscle in the body violently contracts, and most of the time, a healthy cardiac rhythm is restored. This is one mathematical setting where EIT is studied. I will be speaking, especially in the end of the talk, a lot about this geometry. So the problem, of course, is studied mostly in 2D and 3D. This picture, actually, you can think of this either 2D or 3D. So we have this pointer. So this is the domain. Let's say this is the unit disk in the plane. Inside the disk, we have some non-negative, strictly positive, actually, function, gamma, which is electric conductivity. So it's strictly positive, bounded from above. And we look at the conductivity equation inside the domain. We apply some voltage at the boundary. So F is some function, some distribution of voltage we apply at the boundary. Then Maxwell's equations take care of what happens next. There is U, electric potential, inside the domain. And the gradient of U times the conductivity, with a minus sign here, is the current field, which doesn't have sinks or sources in this situation. So the divergence of the current vanishes inside omega. And this is now an elliptic boundary value problem that can be solved mathematically. Also, the nature, when we measure, nature solves it for us. And we define this so-called Dirichlet-Neumann map that is a mathematical abstraction that collects together all possible voltage to current measurements done at the boundary, non-invasively. So we apply F at the boundary, it's the voltage, and we measure the current through the boundary. And it was asked by Alberto Calderon in 1980, can we recover gamma from the knowledge of the Dirichlet-Neumann map? First of all, is it uniquely determined in principle? And if it is, how to recover it? This problem is nonlinear and ill-posed. Why? Let's look at some mathematical details. So the Dirichlet-Neumann map can be viewed as a linear operator between certain Sobolev spaces. And by Green's formula, we can also write such a pairing between functions in those Sobolev spaces. And we find that it's the solid integral of the conductivity times the dot product of these gradients. So the point of this short computation is that the mapping from the conductivity to the measured data is nonlinear because this integral depends nonlinearly on gamma. Gamma appears here, but also the function u here depends on gamma via this elliptic equation. So the whole point of this transparency is just to show you that it is a nonlinear mapping from gamma to the data. And ill-posedness, what is that? Let's look at this very simple situation where we have two disc-like patients with very different internal organs. This patient has this very big disc organ of conductivity 2, and the conductivity near the boundary is 1 in both cases. This other patient has a smaller organ here, but with much larger conductivity. So can we see the difference between these guys from EIT measurements? Let's see. We apply a boundary voltage. I do some kind of oscillatory here, negative, going to positive, negative, positive. The same boundary voltage in both cases. Then you see here the voltage inside each patient. We cannot measure that. What we can measure is, What we can measure is the current through the boundary. So this blue guy gives the blue curve. This is the current through the boundary. This here is the angular variable as we go around the object. And the red curve here is the current through the boundary given by this patient. So although the patients are very different, we have almost the same boundary measurements. Well, of course, it might be just the case that we have a bad F. We can try another F, less oscillatory, just from negative to positive to negative again. Again, not too much difference in the measurements. And if we try once more with more oscillatory, even less difference between the measurements. Well, this is ill-posedness. Two very different patients give almost the same data. So when we want to make an image of the internal structure of these patients, we need to look at what we have as information is these tiny differences in these curves, and we should be able to see the difference between these guys. This is called ill-posedness. Big differences in the object show up only as small differences in the data. Over the years, many different approaches have been suggested for the solution of this imaging problem, given the boundary data, how to make an image of the internal structure. So there are many categories of different methods with different approaches. Today, I will be mostly talking about linearization-based methods where the EIT problem is linearized around some known background conductivity, and just the difference is imaged, and then the so-called D-bar methods. Okay, so let's take a look at the classical application imaging heart and lungs. I think this was David Isaacson's first application he started to look at in the 80s. And here is one picture of a laboratory setting where we have John Newell constructed this experiment for us. Here we have electrodes. They are metal plates, and there are wires. Wires will be attached to those plates. Then there is saline, salt water in the background, and then some agar-based lungs and heart, where by varying the salt content, John Newell made lower conductivity in the lungs, like they had air in them, and higher conductivity in the heart. This is the reconstruction using the D-bar method, which I will describe in the last part of my talk. It solves the full nonlinear problem, so it gives quite a typically low resolution picture, but the contrast resolution is pretty nice. The dynamical range is quite close to the correct one. These are some early experiments they made with their ACT3 machine in Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. This image comes from a linearized method showing how blood is leaving the heart. Here is less, this is a difference image, so blood is leaving the heart and going to the lungs. We can also watch a video of this. This is done by the D-bar method. It's taken from a live subject. Okay, what did I do now? Wrong slide. Okay, let's try again. Doesn't show. Yes. Why? Okay, let me try from the Okay, here we see. So this person is now attached to the Act 3 machine, and there are electrodes attached around the chest, and here is the monitor where we can see soon. Take a deep breath. Now deep breath and hold it. So we can follow. So here you can see how the blood is moving by the heartbeats between the heart and the lungs. I think this is the main part of this movie. I very much wish Dave was here, but sorry about the incomplete explanation. But anyway, I wanted to show you how it is possible to monitor the function of heart and lungs using EIT, and actually even in real time. Now I just need to find where is my... Yes, and another video showing this kind of several belts of electrodes around Dave's chest, and we can see some ventilation pictures in 3D. I hope this works. So this is a three-dimensional reconstruction based on a linearized method. And I think this approach mainly is useful, for example, for monitoring intensive care patients. Dave told me that there was once a clinical trial where there was a young female patient who had a motorcycle accident. She was in a coma, and her lungs were monitored with this method, filling with air and emptying, and suddenly one of the lungs just, this way, I guess, it was empty and didn't work anymore. The lung collapsed, which is a very painful condition for a person who is conscious, but for an intensive care patient, we need something else to detect it. And that was one of the triumphs of EIT, to detect such collapse of a lung in an unconscious patient. Okay, so next let's see what EIT can do in the field of breast cancer detection. This is actually my favorite work in EIT. Dave and his team has done a really great job in advancing finding breast cancer. So these are the people involved from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and also MGH Hospital. And here in the breast cancer detection, the main problem is this. Here you see X-ray mammograms of patients, which one has cancer and which one doesn't. The problem is really difficult because cancer and healthy tissue in the breast attenuates X-rays roughly in the same way. There is not a big difference in the attenuation, so you don't see the cancer as a very bright spot or as a black spot. It's kind of the same, and you can see these elaborate structures and textures, and the radiologist should find out from them what's cancer and what's not. Here see some kind of a mass, is it cancer? Here see some kind of this kind of star-like behavior. Is it cancer? Here, I don't see anything. Okay, let's see how EIT can help. It was first observed by Jocinet that breast tissue actually reacts to EIT measurements when we vary the frequency of the alternating current we feed in. So these are kind of spectra electromagnetic spectra of different kinds of tissues. So this here is benign tumor, here is normal breast tissue, there's carcinoma and some glandular tissue. So they kind of show differently in this frequency spectrum. So Dave and his team have built this kind of a machine where there is actually a regular mammography device with the compression plates here and here. So the breast is compressed here between the plates, and the volume between is voxelized. And they also have electrodes that are translucent to X-rays, so they don't ruin the X-ray images. And they can measure EIT data at the same time when the breast is compressed, which helps the registration of the reconstructions a lot. This is the picture of the machine. So here is the compression plates and the electrodes in the plates. And actually this is done with this ACT4, the new machine they have at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. It's a 64 channel as compared to the ACT3 that was 32 channel. And I think there are lots of other technical advances also in model 4 compared to model 3. Okay, so now there is the electrode array that can be registered with the middle slice of the X-ray tomosynthesis. What they do, they do limited angle measurements and they use tomosynthesis to find the central slice inside the breast. With a healthy breast, it turns out that the frequency spectra look like this, curved everywhere in the tissue. So this is a sign of a healthy breast to see that kind of curves. Whereas for cancerous tissue, you see that these are more straight, these lines, not so curved as in healthy tissue. So Dave and his team devised this kind of measurement unit, the measurement attached a number to these curves, measuring how curved are they. Are they straight or curved? So I guess the more straight they are, the lighter the color in this image. So they created this kind of way to visualize these measurements. So now we can take a look at these cases again. So here is the X-ray or tomosynthetic slice in the middle of the breast. And we have here an image of cancer. Actually, this is invasive ductal carcinoma, so we see a bright spot, so we see straight lines in these voxels in the spectrogram. This is another case, fibroadenoma. Again, different from healthy curves. This is yet another case. This is carcinoma, so this is cancer that has spread already. And let's see, I think there's, so this was the original question, which one has cancer, which one does not? So now if we overlay these new kinds of pictures over the mammograms, we see that these are okay, even though there's a mass, but it's benign, it's not nothing dangerous, but here we see there is cancer. So this combination of X-rays and EIT seems to be really useful for detecting breast cancer, because although EIT has a low spatial resolution, the images are always kind of blurred, that's a feature of EIT, but these features we are looking at have high contrast difference. The healthy tissue and cancerous tissue have high contrast in their electrical properties. So the spatial the X-rays take care of the high spatial resolution and EIT takes care of the high contrast resolution between healthy and sick tissue. Okay, next I'll talk about imaging the human larynx and vocal folds, so this neck area. It's related to this bigger project we have in Finland going on. It's a four-year project aiming to apply inversion mathematics to all kinds of problems, research problems related to human voice and speech research. So there are a bunch of people, very interdisciplinary. We have neuroscientists, acoustical experts, inverse problems people, people from phonetics and vocology. So it's kind of an interdisciplinary project. And today I'm showing you some results from the collaboration between these teams here. So one of the focus areas in this project is occupational voice loading. So people who give lots of speeches or teach or sing are in danger of losing their voice or developing some voice-related health problems. And this can be turned also into big economic losses, even for just in the USA, if we look at teachers who cannot teach because of voice problems, it's annually such a big sum of money. So what can we do? We would like to monitor the voice while it's used non-invasively, so we could see when it's getting loaded, and also we would like to assess how badly the voice has been loaded if it already happened. So what can we do as inverse problems people? We started with this device. This is something the voice researchers use a lot. It's called EGG, electroglottograph. It works like this. You take these two electrodes and hold them here around the Adam's apple near the vocal folds. And then when you make a sound, let's say, you see this kind of a curve. Changes in impedance are plotted just as a curve. Well, this method has many uses. It has been used successfully in many studies, but it also has some problems. Namely, the placement of electrodes varies from time to time, and it's hard to say where the information really comes from and how can we interpret the values of this curve. And because of differences in anatomy and there is no really a reconstruction of the insides, we cannot trust everything in this curve. We can read off some things, but not everything. So one aspect in this research is to try out whether EIT could help in imaging non-invasively what's going on near the vocal folds. So far we have been simulating and doing some laboratory experiments, which I will describe to you now. So we took a CT slice through the larynx. Here you can see the vocal folds. And we took this shape here and created this kind of a simulated phantom and compared the situations with the glottis closed when the vocal folds are touching each other and to the situation when they are open. So because when people speak, what happens when there is a glottal excitation that comes from the vocal folds just flapping against each other, making a sound that sounds something like, and then the shape of the vocal tract will turn that sound into vowels and other kinds of sounds. So our first study was this one, two-dimensional. We had the, as you saw, the electrodes. We put the electrodes around. These are the electrodes in this two-dimensional setting. And we could find that by difference imaging, EIT can find quite a big difference between these situations with glottis open or closed. So this is kind of first encouraging example that something can be seen. Of course, we know from this EGG machine that something really can be seen related to vocal folds, but we want to see more, hopefully something more accurate in location. So we moved on to three-dimensional studies. We used 12 electrodes. This is a simulation study still. We made this kind of a three-dimensional volume with 12 electrodes like this. And there is an empty space like the trachea. And here are the vocal folds that we can open and close by simulation. Again, difference images show that at least with larger openings of the vocal fold, we can see, so this is just a slice through the three-dimensional EIT reconstruction. So it seems that we can detect different openings of the vocal tract, of vocal folds. Then we moved on to laboratory measurements. Here we have, this is kind of like the spine here, and we have a smaller plastic bar, which is resistive material, and we have bigger and smaller amounts of the plastic there. And if we compare this fully full bar without any missing parts and the difference image to this guy, this is a slice through the three-dimensional EIT reconstruction. So we see something, some difference here, and the difference between this guy and this guy shows even better. So this is obviously a work in progress, but this is what we have been doing so far. So we will continue in doing more elaborate studies of this kind of situations, and hopefully also moving on to human subject measurements pretty soon. And what we hope for is we would like to do experiments like first make a difference image, like keeping the vocal folds open, maybe even letting air out, and then closing them. I don't know how to make a sound of that, but closing them, make a difference image, then shout with full power for 2 minutes, which is sure to cause some vocal loading, then do it again, open and closed. And the difference between these difference images could show some of the chemical differences and differences in blood flow in the vocal folds. This is our research hypothesis, and I hope to report positive results in the near future. Okay, then to the final part of my talk, which is the most mathematical. And here I would like to talk about regularization of EIT methods, and especially one of the methods, the D-bar method. If you wonder who are these guys here, this is Jacques Adamard, who introduced the concept of the well-posed and ill-posed problem. And this is the great grandmaster Tikhonov, who introduced the concept of regularization. So let's go back to this mathematical formulation. Now we are again in 2D. This is the unit disk in the plane called omega, and we have this strictly positive gamma inside. And our problem is to find out gamma if we know this Dirichlet-Zeumann lambda gamma. And as we saw, this problem is ill-posed. Conceptually, let's see what it means. Now, here we have the so-called model space X. In this case, actually, it's the L infinity functions on omega. We have here a domain of the forward map. The forward map is the function, non-linear function, taking a conductivity gamma to its measurement data, the Dirichlet-Zeumann map. And this is the domain of F. In our case, it's the space of twice differentiable conductivities that are one near the boundary of omega and strictly positive. So F is well defined on this domain set. This is the image set of the nonlinear map F. I draw it in this curved fashion because F is a nonlinear map. And the structure of this set is actually unknown. The characterization of data that are the Dirichlet-Zeumann maps of some conductivity is an open question and seems to be quite a difficult one. What we measure then is not actually this guy, because there's always measurement noise involved in measurements. We only can measure something that's close to it. Maybe we know that it's at most epsilon away from the ideal data, but this is all we can know roughly. It's some operator, and most probably it's not the Dirichlet-Neumann map of any conductivity. What we should do then, according to the regularization school of inverse problems, is to construct a family of mappings, gamma alpha, that are continuous from y to x, parameterized by alpha, which is a real number between 0 and infinity. It's called the regularization parameter. And alpha should be chosen as a function of the noise level epsilon, in a way that when epsilon goes to 0 in the asymptotical limit of ideal data, this guy should give us back the original gamma in the limit. But however, because we are always given only noisy data, the continuity of this map will ensure that we will get some reasonable reconstruction. I remind you that F itself does not have a continuous inverse. That's in the definition of an ill-posed problem. So now I have this message to all theoretical mathematicians working on inverse problems. Oftentimes it's first proved that there is uniqueness, meaning that there is only one conductivity giving the same Dirichlet-Neumann map. But because the inverse of F is not continuous, that's actually not enough. So often people prove this kind of stability estimates where the difference of the two conductivities is bounded by the difference of their data. I know how hard work this can be, proving this kind of estimates, and I really appreciate those techniques and the effort. Still, I'm sorry to say, it's not enough for taking these techniques to actual practical imaging. What is needed to do is really to construct such family of continuous mappings, because the stability estimates only involve stuff happening on this set here, and this set is not known, not characterized. So more needs to be done than estimates like this, and what is this more is the definition of a regularization strategy, as I told you. So they have to be continuous mappings from the data space to the model space. And if the noise level, if we take alpha to zero and we have ideal infinite precision data available, then we should get actually the actual conductivity back. Then with noisy data, we should introduce how to choose alpha when we know epsilon, and then show the following kind of convergence. So let's see what's happening here. This is the error in reconstruction. This is our reconstruction. This is the original gamma. And the difference between them in X norm is the error in reconstruction. We want that error to go to zero. And there's also this supremum. We take this supremum over all noisy data in the disk of radius epsilon. The supremum is taken over all these guys that are epsilon close to the ideal data. And the supremum of reconstruction errors should go to zero as epsilon goes to zero and alpha is chosen accordingly. Let's look at the current situation. If this is the set of all inverse problems, we would like to cover the whole set with this red color, meaning that we have a proper regularization analysis for the problem in question. The current situation is this. Tikhonov's work and later work by a lot of people shows that that the linear inverse problems are actually quite well understood, how to regularize them. Then there is a lot of great work concerning inverse problems that are close to linear, not quite linear, but somehow close. There is some assumption that they are not too far away from linear problems. So they are quite well understood as well. Unfortunately, oftentimes, this set doesn't cover many of the practically important problems. Here we have inverse scattering, blind deconvolution, optical tomography, ultrasound tomography, inverse kinematic problem, EIT, many non-linear problems that are not close to linear problems. And I'm advocating the view that our mathematical community should go one by one after these guys and provide a regularization strategy to them as an other way to cover the whole thing in red as opposed to just expanding from here. Some things have already been done. For EIT with some inclusion detection problems, there are a couple of studies available. For blind deconvolution, which is also a nonlinear problem, and for a full coefficient recovery involving a partial differential equation, actually there's only one result which is which I'm describing for you today. Our result is part of the tradition of the complex geometric optics solution-based approach to EIT that started from Calderon's seminal paper, followed by some papers in 3D and higher. And then what I'm talking about today is the breakthrough paper by Adrian Nachman in 96, where he showed how to recover C2 conductivities from boundary data. That was a constructive proof how to do it via a so-called scattering transform, and after several years of development of algorithms, we came up with an algorithm and regularization proof how to regularize this method based on the scattering transform, and the trick is to do nonlinear low-pass filtering to truncate the nonlinear scattering transform. So let me quickly show you what are these objects now in our study. So the forward map maps from the L infinity functions to the data space. The domain of F consists of C2 conductivities that are bounded from below, so they're strictly positive, and they are equal to 1 near the boundary. The data space consists of these operators with some extra conditions that are easily enforced in practical situations. So, how does this proof work? In the case of infinite precision data, if we know the Dirichlet-Neumann map perfectly, what we do first, we find this scattering transform, which is defined like this, and then we solve a D-bar equation to get gamma. This is the original proof from 1996, and how it works is that we use our assumption of two derivatives in here. We take the Laplace of the conductivity, square root of the conductivity, divide by conductivity. Here we use the assumption of strict positivity. We define this kind of a Q potential that we use in this Schrödinger equation, and we look for complex geometric optics solutions, originally introduced by Fadeev in 1966. And they are asymptotically close to the exponential function. And here both k and x are complex numbers. So this function, scattering transform, is a complex function of one complex variable defined by this formula. And notice that if this psi here would actually be equal to this exponential function, then a short computation shows that this would be the Fourier transform of Q, just the regular Fourier transform. However, psi is not equal to this exponential. It depends on Q in this way. So this is a nonlinear expression in Q. Q is here and also implicitly in psi. So this is a kind of a nonlinear Fourier transform of Q. Now, the proof goes like this. If we have data, be it infinitely precise or noisy, what we do, we solve this kind of boundary integral equation for the traces or boundary values of these solutions. This is so-called single layer operator with Fadeev-Green's function as kernel. I don't go more into details with that. And if we have infinite precision data, we can solve this equation for any complex number k. But if there is noise in the data, we have to actually restrict to a disk of radius r. I will tell you in a minute what r is. Then we define the truncated scattering transform. If we have infinite precision data, we don't have to truncate, then we just use this formula for all k. But in case of noise, we define the truncated or low-pass filtered scattering transform inside the disk by this formula and as zero for high frequencies. Then we should solve this D-bar equation with asymptotic condition that this mu function goes to one. And we get the reconstruction by this function when k goes to zero and taking a square. And this r truncation radius, or this frequency cutoff radius, is given explicitly as a function of the noise level like this. So this works for small enough epsilon, but can be extended to all epsilon noise levels. But for small epsilon, we can use directly this formula, and the regularization parameter is given just by 1 over the radius. Quite simple. And let me show schematically what's going on here. So in Adrian's case, when we have ideal infinite precision data available, we solve the boundary integral equation for all k and evaluate the scattering transform in the full k-plane. We solve the D-bar equation in the full k-plane without any truncation, and we get perfect reconstruction of gamma by squaring this function. Well, in case of noisy data, we make this computation of the scattering transform, but only inside the disk. We solve the D-bar equation with the truncated kernel, that's the low-pass filtering, and then we get approximate reconstruction. Let's see how this works. Theoretically, what we can prove about this is that we can solve the boundary integral equation and define the scattering, truncated scattering data for small epsilon. And then we actually not only know that this reconstruction error goes to zero, but we also can give an explicit rate of convergence. And how does this show up in practice? Let's look at this kind of simulated example, like heart and lungs. And to be within the assumptions, let's take this kind of a smooth C2 conductivity. We simulate, actually here I compute the scattering transform by cheating, by knowing the conductivity, just to show you how the scattering transform looks like. This is the real part, this is the imaginary part, and it's shown here in the disk of k ranges, in the disk of radius 10. Now, if we use the actual boundary measurements as our starting point, this is what we get. Near the origin, we get some high-quality scattering transform, but once k gets too far away from the origin, the numerical computation breaks down because of the noise. This we observed in the long time ago in our research, and that's what led us actually to this low-pass filtering approach, because it's obvious we can only use this good quality part of the scattering transform. So now this is a simulated example where we take first very small data just coming from the finite element method we use to simulate the data. Then we add more and more noise, always one order of magnitude more noise. This is the maximal possible truncation radius before the scattering transform really breaks down numerically. So when the noise gets higher, we have to truncate closer and closer to the origin, and these are the reconstructions we get. So with this higher low noise and higher truncation radius, we get quite acceptable reconstructions, but then as the noise level grows, we have to truncate more closely and we get worse reconstructions. And what is interesting about this is that here is the truncation radius we can prove theoretically that should work, and it does work, but actually in practice we can use much larger radius. So here is the noise level that goes to zero here. This is in logarithmic scale. And actually we can use in practice a bigger radius and get better reconstructions than predicted by the theory, which is nice. Okay, that's all. Thank you for your attention.